just beginning.
Oh, some of the boys had too much, myself included, I must admit. You know how it is.
How it is?
No, sorry, Rod, I'm afraid we don't know.
The Interrogation. Three crime stories probing some of today's most complex moral issues.
Was Rod Tyler aware of how old you were?
I told him I was 18. It wasn't his fault.
What wasn't his fault?
Kenneth Cranham and Alex Lanapeken star as unlikely partners in The Interrogation, original British drama, starting tomorrow afternoon at 2:15 over on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone midday. Time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Raymond Tallis is a man of many parts, a doctor with a particular interest and indeed expertise in epilepsy. He's also a prodigious writer and thinker. His most recent book is Aping Mankind, Neuromania, Darwinitis and the Misrepresentation of Humanity. That provocative title, Ray, could perhaps do with a little elucidation, but basically I think what you're saying is we got carried away with human beings being simply the product of evolution and the brain.
I agree entirely. I mean, essentially we've moved from one prison, which seems to be a supernatural understanding of human beings, to another prison, which is a naturalistic understanding, the notion that essentially we are beasts. And if you really want to understand us, you look to Darwin, and you look to our brains, which are evolved organs, to see what our minds consist of and so on.
I can see very clearly why you would say that, especially, funny enough, since we're talking about music, which is a very good example of something which you could say exhibits all of the, or many of the properties that you feel that that definition would exclude. However, inasmuch as what we're talking about is, I guess, the mind, it's quite hard, isn't it, to pinpoint what this other thing is.
It is. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The brain is a necessary condition for any form of consciousness, from the slightest tingle of sensation to the most exquisitely constructed sense of self. If you chop my head off, my IQ falls quite precipitously. So there's no doubt that the brain is a necessary condition for consciousness. But it isn't sufficient in itself. We can't identify consciousness just with neural activity. And I think we've got a very interesting job to do, to work out what, in addition, is necessary for us to be conscious of the world in the way that uniquely we humans are.
Since you can't precisely define mind, and indeed in a lot of the book you talk about how people tried to find out where the mind was, but not just the mind, the soul, and of course, you know, there are many ideas put forward. That must be both a sort of question of philosophical kind of import as well as psychological.
It is, and I think the problem is that neuroscientists think that they are doing metaphysics, that they can solve the mind-brain problem by looking at the activity of the brain. And one of the problems with extending neuroscience and neuromania is you take in an awful lot of bad philosophy on the way. And the idea that scientists can now do without philosophers is the royal road to ensuring that they do very bad philosophy.
How do you think that this interest has perhaps coloured the way you savour music?
I think it's made me want to feel very protective towards music when I hear people reducing it to the activity of bits of the brain. You know, reducing Bach to brain tingles makes me very cross indeed. Bach wasn't a tingle maker. He was basically a gigantic human being who drew on his own experience and the collective experience of the people around him and their sense of the transcendent in order to write those pieces for the glory of God and the benefit of a neighbour. So I do feel very protective towards the music when it is subject to this kind of reduction.
There's a very nice moment, just talking of Bach, where you use the illustration of the organ and human organs. Do you know the one I mean?
I do indeed, yes. And in fact, I would like to reiterate to some extent, because a lot of the conclusions of neuroestheticians are that music essentially stimulates our reward centres, and that basically it leads to the secretion of dopamine and other neurotransmitters that are supposed to be associated with reward. But of course, so do taking drugs, and so indeed do sex. And they rejoice when they discover this overlap. And my response to that is to say, well, any technique that cannot tell the difference between hearing an organ played and having someone play with your organ doesn't tell us either the experience of either of those things.
Let's have the first music, which actually is not Bach or organ.
It's Beethoven. And it's a Beethoven quartet. And I discovered the Beethoven quartets really in my early 20s. And I've come to love all of the quartets, I mean, particularly the Razumovskis and the late quartets. So making a choice of one quartet out of so many was really rather arbitrary, but it makes a sort of sense to choose the last one and the last movement of the last one, because it was the last substantive work that he wrote. And I love the way that after the initial difficult resolution, he then breaks out into sheer joy, and actually a simplicity that perhaps he'd set aside in the earlier late quartets. And the famous sort of motif of, must it be? Yes, it must be. It seems to me is such a marvellous affirmation from somebody who really bore the full heaviness of being. mean, what a way to end a career of titanic struggle with a tune a child could dance to. I mean, I find it so moving.
Well, we heard the last movement of the Beethoven String Quartet in F, Opus 135, played by the Medici String Quartet. Well, talking of folk influences and popular music, you are, Ray Tallis, a Liverpudlian.
I am indeed, and I was a young Liverpudlian at a very lucky time, because roughly my adolescence, the miniskirt and the Beatles all arrived at the same time, a pretty explosive combination. And it was extraordinary to be in what we thought was a provincial city that suddenly became a great cultural centre. And the Beatles, we thought they were wonderful, of course we would, being Liverpudlians. What we found wonderful was that other people found they were wonderful and then felt a little bit possessive that they then were sort of owned by the world. But the thing that strikes me about the Beatles songs is they've been so enduring. You know, I mean, kids nowadays love the Beatles. Can you imagine people in 1965 enjoying music, you know, the popular music of 65 years before? I can't remember any of us humming Murray Lloyd songs, for example. But also, the themes they included. I mean, of course, there was a theme of boy meets girl, I love you, and so on and so forth, but Eleanor Rigby and When I'm 64, and so on. These were way beyond the scope of most pop writers.
Which one have you chosen?
I've chosen Let It Be. I mean, it sounds terrifically schmaltzy, but this is transcendental schmaltz. I don't even know what it means, and I couldn't even tell you the words, but it's probably my favourite Beatles song.
Well, it's probably an answer to the Beethoven question we just heard, must it be?
Well, I suppose it is. I never thought there's an unconscious connection. Yes, obviously at work there, yes.
Let it be, let it be, let it be, yeah.
Each time I hear it, I discover another layer of complexity in it. I mean, the range of emotion, the range of pitch and tone, and the complexity of the structure is extraordinary, isn't it?
And on that occasion, I was listening to George Harrison's guitar too, which actually counters the melody in places.
It does, yes, yes. I mean, as a composer yourself, you can probably tease it out in a more precise way than I can, but I'm just amazed at the effects that they produce and the effect it has on me. I mean, it's the mystery of music, I guess, that one is the recipient of effects. One doesn't quite understand the cause.
The Beatles with the Lennon-McCartney number, Let It Be. I mentioned epilepsy, but you've also been very involved in geriatric medicine, yeah. Ray Tallis, haven't you?
Very much so. I was professor of geriatric medicine for nearly 20 years. And
In Manchester.
Yeah. And to me, it combined lots of things. One is the opportunity to follow the special interest I had, which was in neurological disease, epilepsy and stroke as well. Yeah. And the other is the opportunity to see all comers coming through the front door and have the whole range of acute medicine. So it was a very rich form of medicine, and I don't know how people really can continue to enjoy very highly specialised specialties where you're doing the same thing again and again.
And did you, in seeing many, many cases, did you find that there is, in things like music, that people could find means of expression that were cathartic?
It's certainly true with some people with dementia and some people with strokes. Music can reach you when you're beyond the reach of language. Music can be hugely potent when you're not able to communicate in other ways, yes.
Why do you think that is, then?
Well, if one was sort of Schopenhauerian about it, one would say that music speaks directly to the will, as opposed to speaking to us via the mediation of ideas. That's a metaphysical idea in Schopenhauer, but I think it's actually a clinical idea as well. And I feel that it is bypass all those mediations of symbols and signs and does speak directly to us.
Wagner, who we're going to hear next, certainly single-minded in the way he tackled his subjects, and that's what makes it so powerful, I think, that single-minded vision. You would, if we'd been able to have enough of it, have opted, I think, for Tristan.
Probably Tristan, or probably The Ring, or probably both, actually. I mean, it would have been a close-run thing.
We would have required the whole weekend and then some.
Absolutely, yes, yes. But because that was not possible, I thought, how does one choose a piece that, as it were, captures the essence of Wagner in a relatively small time? And I guess the Vaison d'Anglider, and particularly those that were studies for Tristan, like Träumer, that we're going to hear, Dreams, would seem to be the closest one can get to it.
We were talking about the aspects of sensation that differentiate us from animals. And I suppose that Wagner, I suppose one can never quite get away from a feeling of sex and passion and love running just beneath the surface.
It's sex and passion and love utterly transformed and utterly transfigured. I mean, the fact that he unpacks Tristan, possibly from an unconsummated relationship with Mathilde Wesendonck, tells us that basically, in human beings, sex is something totally different from the drive to copulate and replicate one's genes, as it were. It is a tribute to how we human beings take the biological givens and transform them into something utterly different. And to get out of perhaps an unsatisfactory, perhaps unconsummated relationship, something like Tristan is a tribute to the kind of extraordinary and inexplicable creatures we are. Clearly, Tristan has as its central notion the idea that true consummation can only occur in death, that life ultimately is inescapably tragic, and that only on the far side of death will we find any kind of reconciliation, even redemption. And I think that theme is already hinted at in this beautiful, beautiful song. And that's partly driven, I think, by the fact that we're the only creatures and they were going to die. So we have the sense of finitude that runs through the whole of our life. So we know there's the threat of all meanings to be cancelled at any time. And so we long to find a meaning that will somehow resist death, a meaning that will bring all the little tributaries of meaning together at one point of ungainsayable significance. And I guess that's what drives the artist in many ways, even more than the rest of us.
Yeah.
I often think about what Nietzsche said about Wagner. Of course, Nietzsche felt very ambivalent towards Wagner, very positive initially towards the Wagner who, as he said, none can equal him in the colours of late fall, in the indescribably moving happiness of the last, truly shortest joy. Of course, eventually he fell out with him because he felt he was decadent, life-denying, as indeed he was to some extent, with Schopenhauer being his philosophical mentor. Not that Schopenhauer would have anything to do with him. And Nietzsche felt that he was ultimately negative and that against his affirmative yea-saying. But it's true, he captures tones of experience and of emotion that nobody else ever done before, or in my knowledge, has ever done since.
Träumer, one of the Wesendonck-Lieder that is a study for Tristan. Music by Wagner, words by Matilda Wesendonck. We heard Jane Eaglin singing with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Donald Runicles. The interesting point that that makes, and I think for you it's very much summed up in our next piece, Ray Tallis, is that you don't have to understand or know what the words mean. Because music, being an abstract art form, it conveys different things to different people. And then, of course, you find out what the words mean sometimes afterwards, and you get a whole different view of it.
That's absolutely true, particularly of the piece that we're just about to hear. It seems to be the great mystery of music, to me, for whom music is a serious passion. You know, I'm one with Nietzsche. You know, without music, life would be a mistake. But to me, music speaks to me because it is able to convey meaning and significance without reference. And the song we're about to hear, my wife and I, we heard it many times and we found it extraordinarily moving and we couldn't track it down. And one day we went into a shop in Samos, in Pythagoria in Samos, and we sang it to the shop owner, who, to put himself out of the misery, immediately dived into the collection of CDs and produced it. So we'd last tracked it down. My image of what the music stood for was of a perfect elegiac end of a Greek day, with the sun transilluminating, the breaking waves, making them all sort of rosé-coloured like wine and so on. But actually, the song is rather bleak. It's based on a poem by George Sepharis, and it's called Denial. And just to give you an idea of how bleak it is, this is the last verse. With what spirit, what heart, what desire and passion we lived our life. A mistake. So we changed our life. And then we subsequently discovered that it had been a very important anthem of the resistance against the colonels in the early 1970s. So all of these layers of truth about the music were quite independent of our experience of the music.
Πάνω στη μάμο τη ξανθή.
Michael, I wonder what emotion you hear in that music.
Well, I was going to say to you, if you had not told me what it was, but of course I cannot remove that that sentiment from my mind because you have told me, I think I would have thought it was something slightly more melancholy than just a beautiful end to the day in Greece.
Yeah.
There's something that sort of plucks at the heartstrings in a rather more determined way than just a nice serenade.
It does raise the whole question of the relationship between words and music, doesn't it? And I don't know whether I've lost something through knowing, as it were, what the music meant, or whether I've gained something. It's still just as moving now that I know I was moved in the wrong direction, as it were.
We heard Sto Periali to Kryfo by Mikis Theodorakis, performed by Georgis Hidirakis. This idea that you cannot pin down exactly what the music's about, but you bring to it your own subjective feelings, I guess really corresponds with the adage that all art aspires to the condition of music.
And you wonder why Walter Pater said that. It was in one of his famous essays on the Renaissance, the School of Giorgione. And I guess really what he was putting his finger on was that music is essentially made out of elements that don't exist elsewhere. I mean, poor old poets, they use shop-soiled words, you know, words that are used for laundry lists and domestic rows. They have to be, same language has to be used for poetry. And visual artists have to use, as it were, what the visual world serves up. And I think many poets feel extremely jealous of musicians for that reason. And at the time of, I was thinking towards the end of the 19th century, when people like Mallarmé and Paul Valéry and so on got very interested in Wagner, they used to sit in the auditorium listening to The Ring or whatever, and turn to each other and say, how can we compete with this? You know, we're using second-hand shop-soiled components, you know. This chap is making music out of pure notes. Although Wagner himself, of course, was the recipient of some hostility, someone like Hanslick, who felt that music should be absolutely separated from words, suddenly he thought of absolute music, which shouldn't be subordinated in any way to any other purpose than that of beautifully organised sound.
I don't suppose that Thomas Tallis is actually a relative, Raymond Tallis.
He isn't. I wish that he was. I mean, he was married, but he didn't apparently have any children. There may have been a sort of something happened in a back street in, you know, London, Elizabethan times, in which case I'd be very proud if I was the, you know, long-term consequence of that. But as far as I know, I'm not related. No.
But nevertheless, you have an affinity.
Yes, and it's interesting. I'm an atheist, I'm a humanist. Why do I love Renaissance polyphony so much when so much Renaissance polyphony is essentially religious? And that does, again, raise the whole question of the relationship between music and words, music and belief, music and reference.
But if you can love a great cathedral with flying buttresses, you don't have to aspire to religion in order to appreciate it as being a work of beauty.
You're absolutely right. And my own feeling in response to something like Sperminalium or a great cathedral is to say how mighty are the works of man, and how even more mighty, given that they were constructed on something that doesn't exist. What a genius human beings have. Out of that nothingness to create such a somethingness.
Thank you.
My wife described that as early Phil Spector, like a wall of sound, and it is an extraordinary advancing wall of sound, isn't it? And what amazes me about it is here's a man who's commissioned to write a 40-part piece to celebrate the Queen Elizabeth's 40th birthday, and with that apparently, as it were, technical challenge, he creates something that's utterly transilluminated by awe, and it's just unbelievable. And I suppose that's what great artists can do. They produce their best work out of rather seemingly arbitrary constraints. I was thinking about Paul Valéry, the poet who wrote a series of dialogues, and there's one of his dialogues, Upalinus, or The Architect, and it had to be 32,000 characters long. That was in the days before computers could count characters. And it's his greatest dialogue.
Spem in Allium, the motet by Thomas Tallis, performed by the Tallis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips. We're going to end Raymond Tallis with a piece of Bach, which is very suitable given that you are chair of the Healthcare Professionals for Assisted Dying, in that rather like the Beethoven with which we began, Must It Be, this is another piece that, like the Beatles, in a sense, sort of says, let it be, or it is going to be.
Yeah. It does, and this is something I do feel very strongly about, that modern medicine often takes people to places which are simply unbearable, and they have the last few days or weeks of their life which are absolutely intolerable and appalling, and everybody, in particular the person themselves, wish that they could just move off. Just as in this beautiful cantata, the aged Simeon sees the baby Jesus, and he feels at that stage his life is complete. Ich habe genug. And that's the theme of the opening aria. The final aria in this cantata really says, essentially, just take me away. And I find that incredibly moving. The sense, first of all, that your life is complete, but also subsequently that there is no point in continuing with pointless suffering. And I find it a great pity that we're not able to assist people who are terminally ill and who are able to make clear-cut decisions with all the safeguards that we must have in such a situation, and who have made a clear statement of their wishes, are simply not allowed to be assisted to die.
When you hear a piece like that with the sort of lachrymose sound of Sidney Sutcliffe's oboe there, you do feel that music can, as we were saying with the cathedral, regardless of the meaning of the words, can act as something that is transcendental.
It is, and in a way it's not just lachrymose. I get the feeling, certainly with the music in the background, the accompanying music, I suppose, the voice is the voice of Rembrandt's old man, as it were, as I imagine it. But the background music, you get a sense of an old wall bathed in October sunlight. That's the sort of feeling I get with that
And there's
music.
A caressing element to it
there
as well.
There is, absolutely. And of
dance,
course...
A gentle dance, like...
Yes, and Hans Hotter's voice, like black wine, it's just wonderful. Yeah.
Ich habe genug, the opening aria from the cantata of that name, BWV 82 by Bach, Hans Hotter, with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Anthony Bernard. Well, thank you so much for introducing us to this music that means clearly so much to you.
It's been a fantastic pleasure. Thank you.
Raymond Tallis was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the film producer Stephen Evans. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall.
As the Scots contemplate independence and ponder the options for their own national anthem, I'll be concentrating this week on the man who gave England what a recent poll revealed would be the number one choice for an English national anthem, Sir Hubert Parry. Pillar of the musical establishment, but a man who could make Queen Victoria giggle. Her favourite composer was Mendelssohn, and she wanted all music to sound like his. Her subjects duly obliged by writing very proper, but not very original music, until Parry came along, to be hailed as a composer who's capable of restoring our national music to its true place in the art of Europe. Join me, Don McLeod, for Sir Hubert Parry as our Radio 3 Composer of the Week, all this week at 12 noon and again at 6:30.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Vaughan Savage.
The Culture Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has said that now is the moment to put in place a new regulatory system for the newspaper industry and that he would like to see changes made in this Parliament. The Leveson inquiry into press standards is continuing. In a BBC interview, Mr. Hunt said the country needed a much tougher system to deal with newspapers which stepped out of line. He said the body which punished newspapers that transgressed should be independent of proprietors and editors. Rupert Murdoch is expected to fly to Britain this week to meet News International managers following the arrest of 5 Sun journalists and 3 other people as part of Operation Elvenon, the investigation into alleged corrupt payments to police officers. The other arrests include a member of the armed forces and a Ministry of Defence employee. The Shadow Health Secretary, Andy Burnham, has accused the Prime Minister of putting his own political pride ahead of the interests of the NHS by pressing ahead with controversial changes in England. David Cameron has accused Labour of political opportunism for opposing the health bill and says he supports the Health Secretary, Andrew Lansley. A debate is underway at the Greek Parliament on new austerity measures approved by the coalition government in return for more bailout money from the EU and the International Monetary Fund. The Prime Minister, Lucas Papademos, has warned that Greece will descend into uncontrolled chaos if the proposals are rejected. Al-Qaeda has sent a message of support to the Syrian opposition to President Assad and told them not to rely on help from outside. In a video, the terrorist leader Ayman al-Zawahiri warns the opposition not to trust the West, the Arab League or Turkey. One of the biggest selling singers in history, Whitney Houston, has been found dead in a Los Angeles hotel room at the age of 48. She sold more than 170 million records and won more awards than any other singer. The exact cause of her death is still being investigated. The weather. Occasional outbreaks of light rain or drizzle will continue across the United Kingdom throughout the day, with some sunny spells in places. There'll be clear spells overnight with a patchy frost and fog. The BBC News and Weather at 2:30 past one.
And now the Early Music Show. And today, Catherine Bott's subject is a 14th century medieval masterpiece, Le Roman de Fauvel.
Once upon a time, there was a muddy-coloured horse whose very name, Fauvel, stood for vice and vanity. But Dame Fortune raised him from his stable to rule like a king, and men who would once have ridden him were compelled instead to groom him from head to tail. No, it's not a fairy story, but a mordant satire on the corruption of church and state in 14th century France. The Roman de Fauvel survives in several manuscripts, one of which adds music to the mix. To discuss this extraordinary work, I'm joined down the line from across the Atlantic by Dr. Emma Dillon, Professor of Music at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Medieval Music Making and the Roman de Fauvel. Emma, welcome. Can we start with the background to the roman? What is it?
The Roman de Fauvel is a popular French romance. It was written sometime in the second decade of the 14th century. And simply put, it's a fabulous satire on some terrible events that occurred in the royal realm in that decade. You can't complain about these things directly. So the roman is a kind of translation of historical events into a fabulous allegorical story, populated by a horse, Fauvel, and goddesses, virtues, and vices. There's one particular version that you mentioned which survives in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, very special to us because it is amplified with music and with images. And it contains something like 160 songs. And in this way, through image, text, and music, the story is retold. It's a precious resource, it's like a treasure trove for us in terms of music history.
Let me just explain that Roman de Fauvel is divided into three sections across two books. Book one introduces us to Fauvel. He's the muddy, beige-coloured horse who's got ideas above his stable. Dame Fortune raises him to man's estate, and he rules a topsy-turvy world in which men must crawl on their bellies and tend to his every need. Well, we haven't got time to broadcast the whole of the Roman de Fauvel in one programme, but in these evocative excerpts, all the music is from the recording by the Boston Camerata and ensemble project Ars Nova, directed by Joel Cohen. And to bring the text to life in English translation and ready to go now, with me in the studio are actors Caroline Martin and Scott Handy.
Here begins the Book of Fauvel.
I'd rather be a swineherd than rub down Fauvel. I'd rather be flayed alive. I don't care for his money. I don't covet his gold. I'd rather be a swineherd than rub down Fauvel.
Fauvel, the mud-coloured horse, no longer lives in a stable, but somewhere far more becoming. Dame Fortune, much against reason, has made him lord of her abode.
Oh, fickle Fortune, who creates such uncertainty. Why such a prize for one so undeserving? Through him the faith will wander, deprived of its guide.